Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 30 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. Today, I'm talking to Tim Tate about his newest book, Agent Sniper, The Cold War Super Agent and the Ruthless Head of the CIA, which just came out a few days ago. Tim has worked as a documentary filmmaker and an investigative journalist for more than 40 years. And in that time, he's published 18 books and produced 80 documentaries. Some of the topics he's covered in the past include China's slave labor gulags, the worst child murder in British history, and the orphans left behind after the Vietnam War, among many others. Most recently, Tim has turned his investigative focus toward an amazing and relatively unknown story of early Cold War espionage, the story of Michael Golanowski, Polish intelligence officer who became one of the CIA's best agents in place behind the Iron Curtain until he successfully defected to the United States, where everything suddenly changed drastically. Tim, thanks so much for making the time to speak for me. I really appreciate it. I can tell you're a very busy guy, and I know it was not easy to fit this interview in.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Absolutely. I just finished reading Agent Sniper recently because, of course, it's just coming out in the past few weeks, and I was totally drawn in by this story. I'd heard parts of it before, but you really laid it out very clearly, and it's certainly one of the most astounding stories of Cold War espionage that I've come across. What was it that made you choose Golanowski as the subject of your next book?
Well, I'd known a little bit about Golanowski for almost 50 years. I'd first come across his name in the early 1970s, and at that point he had achieved a certain notoriety internationally for a claim he made, which I guess we'll come to shortly. But in those days, it was very difficult to get good, reliable, first-hand information. As a journalist, I like to work from primary source documents, so original material, not what somebody else said that somebody else said. And trying to get hold of that material, trying to find documents from the CIA, from Britain's intelligence services here, particularly MI5, from the governments, was very difficult. And so the research gradually and very gradually tickled along for decades until really, in about 2015, 2016, the first documents began to become available. And at that point, it was clear to me, anyway, that this was a story which was well worth telling, and there was unknown material, previously unknown material, which would support the telling of it.
That's such a great point, because recently, of course, I've read quite a few histories and biographies of the Cold War, and yours really stood out because you do refer back so many times to the original documents, not to summations or anything like that, which I have really learned to appreciate recently, because this history is hard enough to parse as it is. So you really have to go back to the foundational documents to try to get as close as you can to the truth, for certain.
Sure. I mean, everyone, I guess, who writes about the Cold War does so with some kind of, not agenda, but some kind of personal bias or belief system. So going to secondary sources, you know, what other historians or journalists have written can be useful, but it really doesn't get you back to the granular, nitty-gritty detail of what actually was said when, by whom at the time. And that's what I like to do.
Well, it's certainly appreciated, and that really, that level of research really comes through in the story as well.
Well, the research itself took, I think, 2 years and involved me going to plundering, if you like, archives across Europe, all across the United States, and in the UK as well. I mean, in the end, I ended up with more than tens of thousands of individual pages of original documents, or copies of original documents. And that in itself is a fairly large undertaking to try and distill that into something, into a narrative which is understandable and at which actually explains what was going on.
Wow. Well, all that effort certainly paid off, in my opinion, because it's a very readable story. And of course, it takes place over a long period of time and changes in location and many people coming and going throughout, but it was very comprehensible throughout. And so I certainly appreciated that.
Well, thank you. I'm glad it works. I mean, I like to try. History is one thing, but I write narrative history. It's telling a story. And that's my journalist background coming out. So the narrative for me is what has to be clear. Otherwise, why would anyone read it? I mean, what I was trying to tell was a story which was utterly based on original documents. And as well as it being a spy story, I mean, I have kind of an ambivalent attitude to spy stories because they can feel quite boysy, you know, quite masculine. I was very interested in the human side of this. What made this man tick? What made the intelligence agencies who worked with him and or exploited him, what made them behave in the way they did?
I agree completely. And that's really what draws me to this genre as well, because, you know, there's a lot of focus on things like cool gadgets or famous events, but it's still endlessly fascinating to me to figure out what will make a person betray their country or their government or put themselves, you know, their lives on the line for an ideal or for a foreign country or foreign agency that they've never even, you know, met or been a part of. And the psyche of the people involved is just an endlessly fascinating topic for me.
And for me, and, you know, it's, I think to a degree to some extent, we expect spy stories to conform to at least some of the cliches and tropes of Bond. And, you know, it's not like that. Spying's a grubby, nasty, dangerous business. And for someone to risk his life, as Golunovsky did, to betray his country, the communist bloc for whom he worked, for the West, there has to be something driving that. And that's what I was looking for.
Absolutely. So getting into his story, as a matter of fact, how was it that he first came up on the radar of the Western intelligence agencies? Because it was notoriously difficult to get access to anyone behind the Iron Curtain during this time period that he showed up.
Yeah, I mean, this in and of itself is a classic piece of Cold War espionage story. One day in April 1958, an anonymous letter arrived at the US Embassy in Switzerland, and it was signed only with a cover name. Whoever had written it was calling himself by the German name Heckenschütz, which translates as sniper. And it was an offer. He said, I have a lot of Soviet bloc military and intelligence secrets that I would like to share with the West. I will only do so anonymously. Are you interested?
That sounds like an offer that you couldn't hardly refuse, but I understand that it was kind of met with some initial skepticism, was it not?
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, offers like that don't happen very often, to put it mildly, and certainly didn't happen very often for the West, for America particularly, in those days. And there was always the risk that this was what, in spy terms, is called a provocation or a dangle. In other words, something bogus, a false trail being laid by the KGB in Moscow or by another communist intelligence service. So when it came to American intelligence, this offer, there was initially the thought, hold on, is this a trick? Oh, is someone trying to fool us, to lead us down the garden path? And there was quite some debate within the CIA in the beginning about whether they should take Sniper, this mysterious person behind the Iron Curtain up on his offer. In the end, they decided, well, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. You know, we've nothing to lose, particularly in responding. And so they followed his instructions. And again, his instructions were classic of the time. He had said in his letter, to the one that was delivered to the embassy in Switzerland, if you want to take up my offer, then place this coded advert in the classified advert columns of this German newspaper, and I will know that you're serious and that you want me to send you material, and then please arrange dead drops, places where I can send the material to safely.
Hmm. Yeah, that's very smart, and I can see why that's more appealing, because it also means that the potential handler in the CIA doesn't really have to reveal themselves. They don't have to meet him in a park, you know, at noontime or anything like that. They can continue to do things kind of remotely. So I guess that helped to set them at ease a little bit more as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first steps in this long and involved dance that espionage agencies go through. And so they responded, they put the advert, the classified advert, in the newspaper in Germany. And Golunovsky, also Sniper, as he was known only then, responded very quickly. And for the next 33 months, almost every month, almost as regular as clockwork, he sent the West, American intelligence, an extraordinary, I mean, an absolute treasure trove of material. And it was literally unprecedented. This was top secret. These were top secret documents from behind the Iron Curtain. They were Soviet military secrets. They were Soviet bloc espionage secrets. And he did this month after month in extraordinary detail. And all the time, all the Americans knew was that this man was calling himself Sniper. They didn't know who he was, and they didn't know exactly who he worked for.
That's obviously smart on his part to stay anonymous, because he's worried about counterintelligence on the Polish side, on the Soviet side as well. But why was he trying to hide his identity from the CIA when he was the one who initiated contact anyway?
Well, thereby hangs a complicated tale. He did not believe he was dealing with the CIA. In fact, one of the first and most important conditions he'd made in his offer to provide intelligence material to the West was that he would only deal with the FBI. And he said that because he said he knew from his work with Communist Bloc Intelligence Services that the KGB had penetrated the CIA and indeed all other US government departments and agencies. Only the FBI, says Sniper, has not been penetrated, so they are the only people I will talk to. What he didn't know, and never knew throughout the time that he was behind the Iron Curtain, working as an agent in place, as it's called, is that his letters never reached the FBI. They were intercepted by the CIA, and the CIA ran Sniper for 33 months in this incredibly dangerous role under entirely false pretenses. He believed he was dealing with the FBI all the way through. In fact, it was the CIA which was handling him and was gratefully swallowing up all the material he sent.
Hmm. Wow. That's really not setting things off to a good start, I would say, when he's specifically concerned about these issues and they're obviously ignored by the agency in question.
No, I mean, it's really not the way you want to begin a relationship. And on at least one occasion, it came very close to costing Sniper his life. The CIA did begin, towards the end of the 33 months of this period, sharing the information not just with the FBI, but also, because of the nature of the information, with the US State Department, which was also penetrated by the KGB. And inevitably, news of the breach inside communist bloc intelligence, news that there was a mole feeding this material to the West, reached the KGB and the Polish intelligence service, for whom Sniper actually worked. And they began a mole hunt. They began searching for the traitor in their midst. The only thing that saved him was the fact that American intelligence, the CIA, didn't know his name. All they knew was his cover name, Sniper. But there's a surviving letter from Sniper in which he warns the West. He says, "Someone's found out that I'm leaking material to you. Please, please, please be more careful. Because if you aren't, the only thing that's going to happen is that I'm going to be taken outside, put up against a wall, and shot."
That's amazing that he recognizes that the kind of the noose is tightening, so to speak, but he's still willing to continue talking to
him. Yeah, I mean, he, again, it's an indication of both his bravery and what I think we would later come to recognize as his arrogance. But he was helped in one regard by a particular piece of irony. The KGB and Polish intelligence, who are searching for this traitor in their midst, this mole who's feeding American intelligence, they decide to put their best intelligence agent on the case. And they task this agent with finding the mole, finding the traitor. Who was this best intelligence agent they tasked? It was Sniper himself. And that gave him a few more months' breathing space, because obviously he could delay and obstruct the investigation. But towards the end of 1960, both the KGB and Polish intelligence, all the Soviet bloc intelligence services, the key ones, had begun to smell a rat, and Sniper was on borrowed time. And he realized, I think probably around October, November 1960, that for that and for other reasons, he was going to have to get out. He was going to have to defect.
Did he make this clear ahead of time to the people that he was writing to? Because you didn't mention anything about what he wanted out of this deal when he's providing some incredibly valuable information. So did he let them know, eventually I'm coming over and you better be ready for me, or anything of that nature?
Well, just to be clear, there's nothing in any of the documents which I finally prized from the CIA and other archives in the States which indicates that Sniper, Golinevsky, ever asked for anything in return. There was no quid pro quo. He was doing this. He was betraying his country, his system, if you like, of government, out of conviction. He had had this Damascene conversion in around 1955-56, in which he realized that the communist system, which had supported him all his adult life and for whose intelligence services he worked, was wrong, and that democracy and Western democracy was morally the right cause, and that's why he chose to work for it. But there's no evidence that he ever, at that point, asked for anything.
Was there a particular turning point that you're aware of, a moment that he witnessed an act of violence or anything of that nature that made him see?
No, I think it was more a gradual process, and it was the scales falling from his eyes. Bear in mind, he wasn't just trapped behind the Iron Curtain throughout all this time. His job as a spy meant that he was traveling to the West. He was traveling to West Germany in particular to run agents there on behalf of Polish intelligence. And so he was able to see very clearly the difference between the West and the East. But there's nothing which suggests, oh, there was one blinding moment of clarity. It was a gradual process, it would appear, until he reached the point where in early 1958, where he decided, I can't carry on being a Soviet bloc intelligence agent and trying to spy on the West because I don't believe in this anymore.
You mentioned that he's providing unprecedented information and he's the best source behind the Iron Curtain. So why do you think it is that there weren't any more like him at that time if he simply, you know, kind of had his eyes open and realized there were problems and decided to do something about it? Was, I mean, the Soviet bloc was a very large, very populous, you know, region for certain. So what was the reason that he was the only one of his kind, do you think?
Largely Western incompetence.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things which got talked about a lot, particularly in the early to middle Cold War, was something called the missile gap. This was this great fear that Moscow had a huge superiority in intercontinental ballistic missiles. It didn't really. That was kind of a myth and a misinformation. What was much less talked about, and yet is very much more real, was the intelligence gap. The West, particularly the United States, but also Britain, was largely blind. We had very little in the way of good human intelligence from behind the Iron Curtain. Defectors were few and far between. You could count them on the fingers of one hand, frankly. And there was this great dearth of reliable intelligence about what the Soviet Union and its satellite countries were up to. And in that sense, Sniper and Sniper's letters and his information were absolute manna from heaven to the West. It was exactly what they needed.
So what was it that he was providing exactly? Can you give us some details about the information he was sending?
Sure. I mean, he sent many hundred pages of top secret Soviet bloc military secrets. So included in these were details of its atomic weapons program and the location and placing of weapons and weapon systems throughout the Iron Curtain countries. He also, in addition to all this military information, he provided unprecedented details of Soviet bloc spying in the West. And one of the CIA documents I got hold of, which was an assessment of what Golunovsky had provided and his value to the West, absolutely stopped me in my tracks when I finally prized it from the CIA's hands. It showed that he had identified 1,693 Soviet bloc spies.
Wow.
I mean, no one before had ever provided that volume of information, that number of details about spies, and frankly, no one since has ever done that.
My gosh, they can't have even come close.
No, I mean, it's a vast, vast total. And, you know, the majority of these people were working undercover in the West. These weren't spies based in Warsaw or in Moscow or in Budapest. These were undercover agents working, burrowed in, if you like, to the heart of government and industry in Europe, in Britain, and in the United States. And some of them were very, very, very big fish indeed.
Yeah, it certainly seems. I know you covered several of them, and I want to talk about them in a few minutes. With this 1,693 that you mentioned, to your knowledge, was this like providing their full true name, or was it more like there's a code clerk in the French embassy who has been turned, or you know, some kind of nebulous detail like
that? It's a bit of both. In some cases, many cases, he provided chapter and verse. This is the man, this is the woman, this is their name, this is their cover name, this is where they're based, these are the operations they're running. In other cases, it was, as you say, more nebulous. there is a spy, a Soviet spy inside, for example, West German intelligence, he said, or inside Swedish intelligence, who's feeding NATO secrets. And he was able to give enough details for these agents, these spies, to be tracked down, to be identified, and to be brought to trial, to be brought to justice.
I can imagine what an incredible coup this was, just to drop in their laps, well, drop into the embassy, right? This anonymous letter that started all of this off.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, it's not me that's saying he was the best thing since sliced bread. It's the CIA's own internal analysis of Golunovsky's value to the West. Essentially, it says he was the best intelligence asset the West ever had.
Wow, that's really something for sure. If I recall correctly, not only was he providing all of this and asking nothing in return, and not only was he an incredibly perceptive guy, but I think he had like a photographic memory as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a photographic memory, and that was something which utterly flummoxed his CIA and MI5, British MI5, interrogators, because he was able, this is after his defection, he was able to reel off name after name, detail after detail, locations, dates, times, places, from memory. In fairness, it wasn't just this photographic memory he had. He had also acquired a little miniature spy camera, one of these Minox. If you've seen the spy movies, you'll have seen these Minox spy cameras. He'd obtained one of those and had sent hundreds upon hundreds of frames of spy camera material, each one a top secret document from inside Iron Curtain intelligence, to the West. I mean, it was like Christmas and birthdays and Thanksgiving all come up, rolled into one for American and British intelligence.
I can only imagine. So what was his method for transmitting so much information? I guess he had to give film negatives and handwritten pages, but how did he get them safely into Western hands?
At his behest, the CIA set up these series of dead drops. And, you know, again, your listeners will know that a dead drop is somewhere that a spy can go and unobtrusively leave a package, a small package of information, be that documents, be that a little canister of microfilm. And they set them up all across West Berlin. Golunovsky was traveling to West Berlin in his role, in his job as a Polish intelligence service agent. And, you know, one of them, for example, was in the men's toilet in the Zoo station in West Berlin. And there was a dead drop there that he could unobtrusively just drop material into. In other occasions, and this particularly just before he defected, he stashed a whole bunch of microfilms in a tree in Warsaw, in a park in Warsaw, noted down the location, and when he defected, he was able to say to the CIA, to his interrogators, you've got to get there quickly because it's not going to be there long. Someone's going to get it. And so they were able to send someone to recover yet more of these astonishing documents.
It's hard to imagine how many hours he must have devoted over the whole period of his espionage career, just copying and taking photographs, and yet was never quite caught at it, you know, taking all this stuff out of his office. Did he have, how did he do this without being caught by one of his co-workers early on? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, Golunovsky was a very senior figure in the Polish intelligence service, what's usually abbreviated to, referred to as the UB. So he was a very, very, very senior officer in the UB, and he was simultaneously employed by the Soviet KGB, essentially as its point man in Moscow, in Warsaw. Although the Soviets were in an alliance, as everyone knows, with the Warsaw Pact countries, they didn't quite trust the intelligence service of their satellite bloc nations. So they hired Golunovsky, who was a Polish intelligence service officer, to keep an eye on what Polish intelligence was doing and report that back to the KGB in Moscow. And those two roles, those twin roles, incredibly senior, powerful roles, meant that he had a great deal of license within the intelligence community to covertly plunder Soviet bloc intelligence's secrets.
Okay, that makes sense. That was going to be one of my other questions, as a matter of fact. How could the same person have access to locations of nuclear weapons and complete lists of sources in the West and spies in the West? But it makes sense that he was one of the only people for whom information was not really being compartmentalized, I guess, in the Soviet bloc.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he worked for both the UB, Polish intelligence, and the KGB, and that he was in these very, very senior roles, gave him access. And again, this is what the CIA concluded, this is not my conclusion, to the most sensitive of the Soviet bloc intelligence and military secrets. I mean, he was, for those 33 months, when he risked his life as an agent in place to steal these secrets and smuggle them to the West, he was probably in a position that no other spy working for America or Britain has ever been in. He was in pole position to get hold of all this.
Incredible stuff. Just the right man at the right time, the right place, really changed history in so many ways, it sounds like. I have to ask, after the initial doubts about him being, you know, whether he was a provocation or a dangle or not, did they ever stop and think at CIA that this take is just too good? This can't all be accurate information? Were there people saying, no, it's too much or anything like that? Or did they just take it as gospel once they started receiving it during that 33-month period?
There were indeed some voices raised against Golunovsky. The CIA, which we tend to think of the CIA and other intelligence agencies as these monoliths, don't we? I mean, they're this big monolithic agency. But at the time, and we're talking the late 1950s, it was riven and was just beginning to undergo an enormous internal schism. And there were two real power blocks inside the CIA. One was the Soviet bloc division, and the other was the counterintelligence staff. And the Soviet bloc division concluded Golunovsky, sniper as they then knew him, is just the best. I mean, he really is an absolute gift. The counterintelligence staff, and particularly the head of counterintelligence, a man called James Jesus Angleton, was always deeply skeptical and was reluctant at best to accept that Golunovsky was genuine. And that skepticism and that antagonism would come to play a role in Golunovsky's subsequent downfall in the United States.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's another fascinating aspect of that story. Before we go on, Tim, I want to take a moment to fill you guys in on the newest tool that I'm wearing and carrying in daily life. It's the Donovan non-metallic knife from Black Triangle. If you aren't familiar with Black Triangle, then you're really missing out. I love these guys because they put the dagger in cloak and dagger. If you've been following me for a while now, then you probably already know why Black Triangle has called their newest non-metallic knife the Donovan. It's named after General William Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the U.S. Office of Strategic Services during World War II. Under Donovan, the OSS was unconventional, unexpected, and highly effective, just like Black Triangle's tools. The Donovan is manufactured here in the United States. It's made entirely of G10 composite and comes with a thermoplastic sheath and a couple of amazing extras, which you'll have to see for yourself. You can find it at blacktriangle.com. That's blktriangle.com. You can also get 15% off your first order with Black Triangle using the discount code SPYCRAFT101 or by navigating to blacktriangle.com/SPYCRAFT101. I love mine, and I know you're going to love yours too. So, Tim, as a matter of fact, I just did an episode a couple of weeks ago about James Angleton with one of his biographers, Jefferson Morley. And fascinating stuff, but I deliberately did not get into the Golinuski story because I knew that you and I were going to be talking about it soon. But Angleton is such a tremendously divisive figure, and it's so unfortunate that his paranoia and his power really came to play in the Golinuski story as well.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, let's recognize from the outset that Angleton's job was to be paranoid. You know, if you're head of counterintelligence for the CIA, your job is to see deceptions, dangles, provocations everywhere. That's their job. Angleton, unfortunately, took it to extreme lengths. And he was ridiculously secretive, ridiculously conspiratorial, and ultimately he and somebody, another defector with whom he hooked up, were responsible, again, this is according to the CIA's own internal analysis, they were responsible for tearing the agency apart for at least 10 years and likewise tearing MI5 in Britain apart for about 10 years, with the result that Western intelligence was largely dysfunctional at a time when it needed most to be really functional.
I agree, absolutely. Did this already begin? Was this dysfunctionality already present by the time that Golinuski finally defected?
The seeds of it were there, but the spark, who we'll come to, I guess, in a bit, hadn't yet arrived. So when Golinuski comes to the point on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, 1960, that he knows he has to get out of Warsaw, he has to get out from behind the Iron Curtain. At that point, Angleton was still deeply sceptical and deeply hostile, but what Golinuski, what Sniper, as they knew him then, had delivered for 33 months was just such top-grade material that American intelligence was desperate to get their hands on him. So when he said, when he contacted them on a special defector hotline and said, "I'm coming, be ready for me," they literally pulled out all the stops. They flew officers in from Washington, D.C. to Germany to meet him and to debrief him. They put armed guards around the consulate in West Berlin, because that's where he was going to come to, and they put armed guards and vehicles around the consulate because they knew that the KGB and the East German Stasi had a long and somewhat successful history of intercepting attempted defections to the US consulate. Excuse me. So at the point at which Golinuski is about to defect, and he does this on January the 4th, 1961, the US consulate, the CIA, American intelligence is on the highest of high alerts.
I can imagine, with good reason. Like you said, if I recall correctly, Stasi and the Soviets had highly effective kidnap teams ready to go in East Berlin and in West Berlin as well. But I'd have to look for exact figures, but I think that something like over 100 people were abducted from West Berlin and taken back into East Berlin for a variety of reasons, including dissidents, attempted defectors, that sort of thing. But you absolutely could disappear out of West Berlin if precautions weren't taken.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, West Berlin, or Berlin itself, and let's not forget, Berlin was a divided city, though at the point the Berlin Wall had, this point the Berlin Wall had not gone up. It was divided between the Western powers and the Soviet Union, and it was this little enclave geographically inside East Germany. So West Berlin was extremely vulnerable. And it was also the intelligence front line for the Cold War. I mean, there were so many spies from all sides, from all nations, working and operating in Berlin at the time, that Berliners gave their own city the derogatory nickname Agentensumpf, which is German for the swamp of spies.
I hadn't heard that before, but it's certainly fitting, no question about it. It's hard to imagine a place like that any other time or place in history, as a matter of fact.
Well, the only rival was Vienna, which was also a swamp of spies and was also a hotbed of tension and conflict between East and West. But Berlin particularly was the hot zone. And as I said, although there was no physical barrier between East and West Berlin, yes, defectors or would-be defectors had been impeded. There were sometimes physical fights on the streets between Eastern and Western intelligence services.
Hmm.
You know, this was a dangerous place to defect, and yet it was the only place he could defect.
It was the only place he had easy access to at that time, I guess, because of the agents that he himself was running in West Berlin. He could get in pretty easily.
Yeah, I mean, he literally took a train from Warsaw to East Berlin, which was a fairly regular service, a lengthy train ride, on Christmas Day, 1960. He arrived at night in East Berlin. Now, he was allowed to go to East Berlin. He'd been given special permission by his masters in Polish intelligence to go to Berlin, and he was allowed to go to East Berlin with some degree of ease. From there, if he could evade the surveillance teams which followed him everywhere for the next few days, he would be able to get himself from East Berlin to West Berlin and to the U.S. consulate on Clay Alley.
So because he had contacted the CIA or contacted the U.S. government anonymously to begin with, did they even know at this point who he was? Did they know who would be arriving by name to defect? Or was it still a mystery to them?
It's one of the oddities of this story is that at the point at which this defection is about to happen, and we have an absolute timetable of this because I got the CIA's own logs hour by hour of the events of that day. At that point, neither Agent Sniper on the one hand nor American intelligence on the other knew who the hell they were dealing with. The Americans just knew that this was a man calling himself Sniper, and Sniper thought he was dealing with the FBI. So there were going to be some shocks in store at the point when he finally got to the consulate.
Well, yeah, it's hard to imagine that. They call it the wilderness of mirrors for a reason. That's a very apt description, for sure. Everybody lying to each other.
Yeah, I mean, it
in a hunt for the truth of all things.
It is, and that's why right at the beginning when we were talking, I said, you know, spying isn't this glamorous business. It's grubby, it's sordid, it's cold and dirty, and, you know, there just isn't glamour in this. And yet, for some reason, we perceive it to be glamorous.
I know it. It's a strange mix for sure. I've covered a lot of stories over the past couple of years, you know, with this project, this undertaking, and almost none of them have any sort of a happy ending, as I'm sure you're well aware from all the research that you've done. But it's endlessly fascinating, but not uplifting in any way, really, the whole profession.
Yeah, I don't think anyone comes out of the Golunovsky saga with entirely creditably. Every single person who is part of this tale has both good and bad, not just to their characters, but to what they did.
I agree. So how did his defection go? Was it eventful? Did he face any actual opposition on his way into the consulate?
It was certainly eventful. He spends the few days between Christmas and New Year dodging and ducking and diving and trying to evade the security the surveillance teams from the Stasi and from Polish intelligence. And he also collects some more foreign currency. He's stashed a whole load of that away for safety anyway. He collects yet more documents that he's had ferried to himself secret documents, which he's going to hand over to the West. And he also finds time to go and visit his mistress. Sniper Golyanevsky was married. He was married to a Russian woman living in Warsaw, and they had three children. He abandoned all of them when he defected, and one of the spurs for his defection was his mistress, who was an East German school secretary, slightly younger than him. So as he's running up and down the streets in Berlin and trying to duck and dive and avoid the people who are tailing him, he manages to go and meet his mistress, a woman called Irmgard Kampf, and he tells her, we're going to get out of here. Are you coming with me? I'll marry you. He doesn't tell her he's married. In fact, she doesn't know his name either. nor do her parents, who are also going to have to get out of East Berlin, because once she's gone, the Stasi will come looking for them. It's the most frantic, tense, worrisome three or four days, not just for Golyanevsky Sniper, but for this slightly bewildered East German young woman, Irmgard Kampf, and her elderly parents. And they finally, Golyanevsky and Kampf, finally arrive at the consulate at around 6 o'clock in the evening on January the 4th, 1961. The consulate had no idea that he wasn't coming alone. He'd made a one phone call to them saying, I'll be bringing my wife with me. She wasn't his wife. Please treat her well. And that puzzled them. But they usher both of them quickly inside the building to the safety, if you like, of American territory, to begin what they presumed would be a fairly swift debriefing, followed by an equally swift emergency exfiltration out of Germany. They'd planned to fly them out of Germany that same evening. It didn't quite go that way.
Yeah, seems like things started to go sideways for Golyanevsky almost immediately after he defected. It was kind of the golden times were coming to an end by the time he actually came to the United States. So can you run through a little bit about his first few days under the, I don't know if I'd call it the care, under the supervision, under the watch of the CIA?
Sure. I mean,
as they verified his identity or attempted to verify his
that
identity?
That first evening set the tone for what was going to follow for the next 3 years. There was an entirely farcical situation in which he's identified himself as Sniper, and he said the woman with him is his wife. She wasn't. They're interrogated briefly, and they both ask, or Golyanevsky Sniper asks at that point, for political asylum for both of them, and that's normal. And the Americans say, sure, we'll give you both political asylum, but you've got to tell us your real name. And that should have been simple. It shouldn't have been an issue. But he paused and he said, yeah, could one of you take my wife, mistress, out of the room, please? So there's this ludicrous situation for half an hour, an hour, where this bewildered young woman is walking up and down the corridor with an American intelligence agency, while Sniper says, you know, I had to get her out the room. She doesn't know my real name. She doesn't know that I'm a spy. She thinks I'm a Polish journalist. And she doesn't know we're going to defect to the United States. Please don't disabuse her just yet. I'll tell her my real name in good time. But, you know, because if you give her too many shocks, I think she could have a nervous breakdown. It was the most bizarre few hours that followed. But eventually, finally, after yet more farcical interludes, Golyanevsky hands across his Polish Intelligence Service identity card. And that shows him to have been a lieutenant colonel in the UB, the Polish Intelligence Service, and it establishes his bona fides. And at that point, the American Intelligence Service, the interrogators, are absolutely ecstatic. They say this in their own documents. The best agent we've ever had is safely with us, and he's going to give us yet more secrets. It was too late to fly him out, to fly them both out of Berlin that night. So they took them the next day, early the next day, to a defector reception centre in near Wiesbaden, with the intention of having maybe a day's quick debriefing and then putting him on a plane to the US. That didn't work out either, because once Golianewski started talking, you couldn't stop him. And it took a week before the Americans were ready to put him on a plane, him and Kampf on a plane, to a safe house in the United States. And it was only then that Golianewski fessed up to his mistress about who he was, that he was a spy, and that they were going to the United States. And it was also only then that the CIA fessed up and said, I know you think you've been dealing with the FBI, but actually with the CIA.
Everybody working under an alias, seems like, in the whole situation, except for poor Irmgard.
Yeah, I mean, poor Irmgard. She was unquestionably in love with this rather imposing, powerful figure, the man she thought was a Polish journalist, but who was, in fact, a Polish intelligence service officer. And, you know, we know that because I got hold of Golianewski's Polish intelligence service file. It's 1,100 pages, and it's extraordinarily detailed. It is an absolute goldmine of information. And in that, there are telegrams and intercepted phone calls between them when he was in Warsaw and she was in East Berlin. And it's absolutely touching and quite poignant. She was deeply in love with him. And I think he was probably in love with her, though perhaps not quite as deeply. I mean, in fairness, he had another mistress back in Warsaw at the same time. Yeah.
Of course he did.
Of course he did, yes.
Well, with all these identities, you've got to have a separate family for each one, I guess. That might have been his justification.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the things which made him, which brought him initially under suspicion within his own intelligence service inside Poland. The fact that he was married in Poland, that he was conducting not one but two affairs, one in Warsaw, one in East Berlin, and that they knew, because they'd intercepted the communications, that he'd promised to marry, bigamously, both of these women.
Oh, boy. He should have probably asked for some money from the FBI right up front, because he's going to need it to have all these different lives he was planning to live.
Well, I mean, he'd already stolen a lot of money from the Polish intelligence service, from his masters in Polish. Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, he'd been plundering office funds for hard currency, for dollars, for pounds sterling, for Deutschmarks, for a couple of years. And he'd funneled a lot of this to Irmgard. That inevitably had brought her to the attention of the East German secret police, who looked into her bank accounts and couldn't quite work out why on earth this rather ordinary school secretary should have such a large sum of money in her bank.
I can imagine. Yeah, the indicators are starting to pile up, and the shine is starting to wear off of this guy a little bit. He's not a perfect golden boy like they had hoped for, I suppose.
No, I mean, and that's why I said, you know, no one comes out of this entirely clean. Golianewski was, and again, this is from his Polish intelligence service file, he was arrogant, he was incredibly gifted, extremely intelligent, but arrogant, didn't suffer fools, and was also quite greedy. And all of these things would play a part in his subsequent downfall.
Mm-hmm. So these debriefings, once he gets to the United States, he gets settled in, of course, and he goes in for very, very long periods of debriefings. And as I understand it, we talked a little bit about some of the close to 1,700 spies that he identified, but can you talk about some of the really big names that ended up being uncovered based on his information? There were some of the biggest players of Cold War espionage all came down to his debriefings.
The very first one, which he had identified or helped identify a spy in the British Admiralty, in fact, in the underwater detection establishment, which was a research establishment for the Navy here in Britain. And thanks to Golianevsky's or sniper's material, MI5 here had been monitoring this spy for the best part of a year. He was a fairly ordinary little man called Harry Houghton, but they discovered that Houghton had a girlfriend, another fairly ordinary woman called Ethel Bunty G. So there were two spies inside the Admiralty, and they were sending top secret naval material to the KGB. But they also discovered, from following these two, and bear in mind the only reason that they were able to follow these two was because Golianevsky, sniper, had identified them. They discovered that they were being run by a previously unknown KGB controller, a man who appeared to be a Canadian businessman, but who it turned out was using false papers and a false identity, and was in fact a senior KGB officer, what was called an illegal, someone who was operating under the radar with a cover identity as a businessman. And this man, Konon Melody was his real name, was a major spy runner in Britain. Not merely was he running these two British spies, but following him led to two more KGB spies operating under false identities in London, who turned out to be Russian agents on the run from the FBI, from dating back to the days of the atom spies in the early 1950s. So this entire spy ring, if you want to call it, the Portland spy ring as it's known, was exposed because of Golianevsky's material. And that was the first spy ring to be wrapped up. And they were arrested literally as Golianevsky was being debriefed in the defector reception centre in Wiesbaden. The next, beyond that, and in no particular order, he identified, and his information was the crucial information in identifying and then breaking Moscow's man inside MI6, our most secret intelligence service. And that was a man called George Blake. He'd been a spy for Moscow for more than a decade, and he'd betrayed scores of British agents to the KGB. In fact, many of them had been killed, executed as a result. And he'd also betrayed the biggest joint American and British intelligence operation of the early Cold War, the Berlin Tunnel, where we burrowed underneath the ground to tap into telephone and cable traffic coming out of East Germany. Well, Blake betrayed that to the KGB from day one, so that nothing that this extraordinarily expensive and convoluted plan that we had, this scheme, the Berlin Tunnel, nothing could be believed. It was useless, worthless.
I think if I recall correctly, the very first time that a presentation was made, a joint one between CIA and MI6, about the proposed tunnel, Blake was in that meeting. I think he was like the official note taker or something like that. And he just immediately turned it over to the Soviets, this incredibly audacious operation, which otherwise would have been a hallmark of the entire era, probably, but betrayed right from the start.
Absolutely right. He was the, as you say, the note taker. He was the administrative officer handling this on behalf of MI6 and the CIA, and was in on the very first meeting and every meeting thereafter. And from day one, he handed all that information over to his controller, his KGB controller in London. And, you know, what should have been an absolute triumph for the CIA and for British intelligence was an absolute disaster.
Yeah, it's really amazing what one person in the right place can do to help or harm an organization. In Blake's case, he harmed MI6, and in Golinovsky's case, he harmed the UB and the KGB as well.
Yeah, there was what struck me when I was working through all these documents was that Blake and Golinovsky had something in common. All right, they were, from, if you like, opposite sides, but both of them were spies from conviction. A lot of the Cold War spies who defected or who operated on behalf of one side or the other, particularly on behalf of the West, were doing so for not ideological reasons. They were doing so for money. They were doing so for the hope of a better life. Both Golinovsky and Blake believed. They were true believers. Golinovsky was a true believer in democracy and, as he saw it, the evils of Soviet communism. Blake was a true believer in Soviet communism and vehemently opposed to what he saw as the evils of Western democracies. So they were almost flip sides of the same coin. And to that extent, it's somehow fitting that Golinovsky was Blake's nemesis.
It really is. Absolutely. It's poetic for sure. I think Blake just died in the past year or so in Moscow.
Yeah, Blake died it's a little more than a year ago. But yeah, I mean, and Blake, by and large, never resiled from what he'd done. He remained a true believer in communism to the end of his days, just as Golinovsky, despite all that would happen to him in the United States, remained a true believer in Western democracy.
Yeah, that absolutely. It's two sides of the same coin. It's a fascinating duality there for sure.
Yeah, so those were the big ones in Britain, if you like. But it wasn't just Britain. I mean, the spies, the major spies that Golinovsky identified, and his information was the crucial information in exposing them and allowing them to be arrested, tried, convicted, and jailed. There was a long-term agent based in Sweden, a man who was a Swedish Air Force colonel. He had worked for no fewer than four rival intelligence services, often at the same time, including the CIA and Nazi intelligence during the war, and then the KGB. And he had betrayed Western secrets to Moscow. In fact, sorry, it wasn't the KGB, it was the GRU. He had betrayed Western secrets to Moscow, NATO secrets, US military secrets, US intelligence secrets. He had betrayed them for decades. Again, Golinovsky was the man who was able to say, this is where this spy is, this is his rank, this is what his code name is. And that enabled Swedish counterintelligence police to track him down, arrest him, and he was sent to prison for decades, rightly so. In Germany, in West Germany, and bear in mind, West Germany was the front line of the Cold War, the head of counterintelligence for the German Foreign Intelligence Service was a Soviet agent, a man called Heinz Felf. He'd been betraying not just West Germany and West German secrets to Moscow for more than a decade. The CIA had given him access, because he was a senior West German intelligence officer, the CIA had given him access to some of its most important spying secrets, including the names, cover names, real names, locations and identities of scores of CIA officers and agents across Europe. Well, Felf betrayed those to the KGB in a heartbeat. Again, it was only Golunovsky's material and information that enabled Felf to be caught, arrested, and jailed. And then there was Israel. There was a Soviet agent working at the heart, inside the heart of the Israeli government and the Israeli Defense Force, and had been a Soviet agent for decades. Unusually, Golunovsky was able to give the Americans, and thereby the Israelis, the man's name. It turned out this agent inside Israel, Israel Beer was his probable name, wasn't just high up in the IDF and inside the Israeli government. He was a personal confidant of the Israeli Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion, and he'd betrayed all of these secrets to Moscow for decades. Again, only Golunovsky's information stops this hemorrhaging secrets.
It's incredible stuff. These are some of the biggest names of Cold War espionage, and they all come down to one man. It's hard to imagine we'll ever have a defector that will top him, honestly. And it's been over 60 years now, and I don't think anybody has come close to him, honestly.
Again, it's not me saying this. It's the CIA's own assessment. No one has come close to him in terms of the sheer number of spies he exposed and the sheer quality of information and breadth of information about Soviet bloc spying rings and espionage operations that he was able to provide.
Incredible. So when he defects, when he goes to West Berlin and then flies to the United States, of course he comes up missing from his job. So how quickly did the KGB and the UB realize that he had defected, and what was their response? Did they plan any revenge or try to discredit him, or what exactly?
The UB realized he'd gone within a day, and that was one of Golunovsky's great fears. He said, they're onto me. You've got to get me out of here quickly. Within a day, according to the documents I found in Golunovsky's Polish intelligence service file, the UB had sent a very senior officer, to Berlin to look for Golunovsky, to look for Kampf, and to try and find out what had happened. And within 48, 72 hours, they realized our bird has flown. We've got a major, major problem. And at that point, both Polish intelligence and the KGB have to start trying to limit the damage. They sent urgent cables around to their offices all across Europe and indeed South America, saying, we've got a defector. He's gone. He's going to betray everything. Please start reining in your contacts. Start being careful, because you're going to get picked up. You're going to get arrested. And indeed, sure enough, a large number of Soviet bloc agents were arrested as a result of Golunovsky's information.
Oh, yeah, with good reason.
Yeah, he's given this treasure trove of information, and the West, European countries, Britain, under the prompting of the United States, starts rolling up the spying networks which were betraying Western secrets to Moscow. At the same time, the UB realizes it needs to have an internal investigation into exactly what he's taken and what he's going to give the West. And there's two or three lengthy documents in the Polish file in which you can read them in real time, realizing, oh God, he's got this. They broke into his safe. He had a locked safe in his office in Warsaw, and realized that he'd accumulated a vast number of documents which he shouldn't really have had. And they recognized that he'd photographed them using his little Minox spy camera, and that these were going to be in American, in Western hands. And you can almost feel Soviet bloc intelligence putting its head in its hands and realizing just what a catastrophe has occurred.
I can imagine just incredibly harrowing damage assessment from their perspective. I'm sure he had access to everything. He was so trusted. He had years of stuff. Nobody looked in his safe before now, and he's gone. He's out of our reach.
And in spring of 1961, while Glogonevsky is in the safe house on the east coast of the United States, Poland puts him on trial in absentia and in secret. There is a trial held in the military court in Warsaw. Now, trials like that of traitors, and he was charged with betrayal of the homeland, which is treachery, would normally be publicized in the East. They would be show trials. There would be a tearful confession by a spy. Well, they didn't have Glogonevsky, but every last bit of this trial was kept secret. It only lasted a day. All the evidence was heard in secret. And in secret, and I got the transcripts of the testimony and of the judgment, Polish intelligence was able to be really frank to the court. And it said, essentially, it's going to take us 5 years to recover from the damage he has inflicted. And at the end of the day, unsurprisingly, the court sentences Glogonevsky to death. They can't get their hands on him at that point, but they impose a sentence of death for treachery.
Yeah, understandable at that point. The most damaging spy probably in their history, for sure. But it was, I guess you can't call it a fair trial since he wasn't there to defend himself, but it was kind of by the book, if I recall correctly from your book, and they had a enormous amount of actual evidence against him that they entered into the record, didn't they, which you were able to uncover?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, yeah, I mean, the, procedurally, it couldn't have been a fair trial because, as you say, Glogonevsky wasn't there, but there was no exaggeration, there was no playing to the gallery, because there wasn't a gallery. Everything which the court convicted Glogonevsky of, he had done. He'd stolen not just money, but he'd stolen all these documents, and he had given them to the West, and we know he'd given them to the West, because we've got the Western side of this too. So, you know, in that sense, the court was perfectly justified in reaching the conclusion that Glogonevsky was a traitor, and the sentence for being a traitor for betrayal of the homeland was death.
Right, yeah, if not unreasonable under the circumstances, I guess if you're seeing it from their perspective, for sure.
Sure, I mean, yeah.
So did they take any further steps after the trial to attempt to get to Glogonevsky in the United States?
Oh, yes. One of the things, you know, which was extraordinary when I got hold of this Polish file. And as I say, it's 1,100 pages of material. From really fairly shortly after the trial, for the next 8 years or so, almost 10 years, the Polish intelligence mount this extraordinary twin-pronged operation. And it was given the code name Teletechnik, and that was Glogonevsky's code name as well. And it had two ambitions. It was run on two tracks. The first was to try and find him. And the only reason to try and find him was to execute him, was to fulfill the sentence of the court. And the second was simultaneously, and eventually it took over from the first, was to discredit him and to embarrass the West with the truth about Gogolevsky. And so, yeah, it spent an enormous amount of time. And, you know, these schemes, I should say, they were Byzantine and Baroque. They involved spies or agents, Polish intelligence service agents in the United States, desperately tapping up every source they could think of, including businessmen, Polish businessmen who knew other businessmen who were going into the White House, in the hope that someone could tell them where the hell Gogolevsky was being held in the United States.
Yeah, did they have any kind of effective reach in the U.S.? I mean, West Berlin is one thing. They had that covered for certain, but, you know, crossing the Atlantic is another thing entirely. Did they have anyone that could actually get to him, or did they come close in their multi-year attempts to get him at any point?
I mean, and the answer to both questions is yes. You know, there's a large, and always has been, a large Polish community in the United States. And some of those people in that Polish community, and the book talks about one in particular, were working for the Polish intelligence services. And they, you know, there were these schemes that were dreamed up and put into action to, first of all, to find him, find Gogolevsky, and then to discredit him, made use of agents within the Polish community and agents of influence whom they contacted on behalf of Polish intelligence. It went on for years, and yeah, it had quite some reach. And eventually, yes, they did track Gogolevsky down. The scheme and the plot which led to this was utterly Byzantine. But they track him down, and they send agents into the apartment block where he's living to try and identify exactly which apartment he's occupying.
Incredible. After all the effort that went into hiding his identity, and they're zeroing in on him nevertheless.
Yeah, and, you know, we should be clear, this is taking place over a lengthy period throughout the 1960s. So Gogolevsky ends up in the safe house just outside D.C., Washington, D.C., a week after he's defected, and he's debriefed there. And the CIA record of these debriefings is unusual, to put it mildly. Normally, it would be the CIA interrogator in control. Mm-mm. With Gogolevsky, he held court. He assumed the dominant position, and he was going to tell the CIA, this is what I know, this is what you should do. And that never changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a forceful personality.
Oh, to put it mildly. The CIA, CIA itself realizes what an asset he is and is prepared, I suspect, to go along with this dominating, demanding figure because he's so important. To the point where it's given him a new cover identity, calling him Franz Roman Oldenburg was his cover identity, and it goes along to the state of Virginia, this is the CIA doing this, and gets Franz Roman Oldenburg, who didn't exist, identity papers, so he could marry his mistress, Gerd Kampf, in Arlington, Virginia. And I got hold of the marriage license, and it's sponsored by the CIA officers, who are guaranteeing this man hasn't been married before. Oops, he was still married. And
right,
they shower him with money, they give him his own apartment, they give him huge sums of money, they promise him a contract, first as a consultant, then to be turned into a full-time employee of the CIA. And beyond that, they begin sponsoring a private law, a private act, a bill in Congress to bypass American immigration regulations so that Golunovsky can apply for US citizenship. And that bill, HR 5507, dragged its way through Congress for a couple of years.
Yeah, he's got a congressional bill specifically about his personal issues, and he's the only factor in this entire congressional bill, right? I've never heard of anything like that before. I thought that was quite something. It really showed his importance.
Yeah, I mean, U.S. immigration regulations law at the time said that if you have worked for the government or intelligence services of a communist bloc within the last 10 years, you can't apply for citizenship. You can come over, you may be brought over here, but you can't apply for citizenship. Well, Golunovsky plainly had worked for communist bloc intelligence and communist governments. The way around this was this private bill, this HR House Resolution 5507, which recognized the extraordinary contribution this man had made explicitly. It names him, it says what he's done. It's a slightly false biography of him, but you know, nonetheless, here it is. It says, this man, Mikhail Golunovsky, he's been great. He's helped us immeasurably. He's risked his life. He's of great continuing value. And he needs this bill, this act passed by Congress, so he can apply for US citizenship. That all should have been good and should have ensured that Golunovsky had a safe and comfortable life in the United States. But once again, it didn't turn out that way.
Right. I know that I guess you would call it like the third act of his life takes a decided downward turn there, unfortunately, once he's here in the United States. And even after all the value that he's provided, things kind of, you know, the last few chapters of his life are a very sad note. So can you just talk about that a little bit? I mean, eventually the CIA turns against him and he's got these mental health issues that come to the forefront, and it's a real mess.
It's a complete mess, and it's not just a downward turn. I mean, if you as you say, if his life is in three acts, and his defection and his first two or three years inside the US are Act Two, Act Three is a screeching handbrake U-turn. I mean, it goes so far off script and off the rails that you literally could not write this as a movie.
Yeah, it seems too far-fetched, honestly, but it's not. It really
is. Yeah. In the middle of 1963, this is just at the point where this private law is going through Congress. The sinister, and I think he was sinister, head of counterintelligence in the CIA, James Angleton, gets control, by and large, really takes control of the agency. And he does so in tandem with another defector who's turned up from inside the KGB, a man called Anatoly Golitsyn. Now, with hindsight, and this is the CIA's own hindsight, Golitsyn was either a lunatic or a con man. But he tells Angleton and the CIA, I am the only true defector. Everyone who came before, everyone who comes after, they're fakes. They're bogus. They're dangles. They're provocations. I am the only true source. And Angleton swallows this. And what happens to Golunovsky happens because Golitsyn essentially denounces him as bogus. And from that moment, I was able to date it very closely to the summer of 1963. From that moment, the CIA begins, at the same time as it's sponsoring this private legislation, it begins harassing Golunovsky. It begins to slow walk his intelligence leads. Towards the end of 63, the harassment gets more severe. It confiscates, or attempts to confiscate, the handgun it has given Golunovsky for protection and orders New York Police Department, because he's living in New York, it orders NYPD to cancel his gun permit. Now, this is at the same time as Polish intelligence service agents are looking for Golunovsky to kill him. From then on, so from the summer of 63, the CIA, which is now dominated by Angleton and Galitzin, in tandem with Galitzin, begins harassing Golunovsky. It stops paying him. It doesn't fulfill its contract. It resiles from its contract. It causes Golunovsky huge emotional and financial problems. And this goes on all throughout the late 1963 and early 1964. Bizarrely, at the same time, the CIA has just written, by early 1964, the assessment of Golunovsky, which says he's fabulous. So you have this almost schizophrenic schism inside the agency, which begins to bring down this incredibly valuable defector. And that's part one of Act Three. Part two of Act Three is when Golunovsky sabotages himself.
Was this with the radio interview that he gave?
What many of your listeners, if they know the name Golunovsky at all, they may know, and this is right when we started the top of this interview, this is what I had heard in the early 1970s and what piqued my interest. Mikhail Golunovsky, in middle 1964, May 1964, publicly claimed to be this miraculously surviving son of the last Tsar of Russia, the Tsarevich Alexei Nikolaevich Romanov, he claimed to be, who had somehow escaped the assassination of the entire Russian imperial family in Ekaterinburg in 1918, and was here now in the United States. I am, he said in this radio interview and then in press interviews, I am the heir to the Russian throne. He wasn't. He absolutely wasn't. It was a complete fraud.
What was the catalyst for this? I mean, obviously his treatment with the CIA has changed, but that's a vast leap from being unhappy with the way you're being treated by this agency to, you know, declaring you are a dead Russian and who was 20 years older than you to begin with.
Yeah. If we can just paint a little background in here. At the time, Romanov fever was kind of big, not just in the United States, but all over the world. I mean, there had been the whole Anastasia story was rumbling on. There had been the Hollywood movie about Anastasia. And bear in mind, at that point, the bodies of the Romanov family, the Tsar, Tsarina, and their children, had never been found. And there had been persistent claims and allegations and pretenders that they had survived. So into this pool steps this top spy, this incredibly important, valuable spy, who presumably, because the CIA has supported him, has some credence, and says, I'm Alexei Romanov. I am the heir to the Russian throne. That's the background. How and why he did that is a whole different story. And although the CIA would later say, well, it shows that the man was quite mad, and Golunovsky did go mad, at the time, it wasn't madness that drove this ludicrous pretense. It was greed. Golunovsky was a greedy man. And there had been, and there was at the time, a widespread belief that sitting in American banks was an unclaimed vast fortune of imperial Russian money, which the Tsar had allegedly smuggled out. And Gogonevsky saw this, and he saw the opportunity to claim it for himself. And it was estimated then to be between $200 and $400 million. So in the billions, billions today. There's no evidence, frankly, that this actually ever existed, but it had been talked about in the newspapers for 30, 40 years, and in the New York Times and elsewhere. And Gogonevsky, the interviews that he conducts at the point when he announces himself to the world as Alexei Romanov, he makes plain that he wants to get his hands on this supposed fortune. And that's what drove him. Hmm. It was greed. It was pure. It was greed, pure and simple. The problem is that once he'd gone public, he began digging himself into a hole he could not get out of. And so come September 1964, when stories about this miraculously surviving Romanov have gone round the world. In September 64, Gogonevsky decides he's going to get married again. He's going to marry Irmgard again for the second time, still bigamously, so it's a double bigamous marriage. This time he's going to get married in New York, and he obtains a marriage license in New York. But he's not going to get married in a civil service. He's going to get married in the Russian Orthodox Church. And the priest who's going to officiate is the most senior cleric of the Russian Orthodox Church outside Russia. He is the biggest fish in the religion. And the name on the marriage license, and the name in the parish register, and the name under which he was married, Alexei Romanov. At that point, and within hours, I should say, the daughter that Gogonevsky and Gerd Kampf had conceived was born. Gogonevsky registers her birth with the state of New York in her imperial name. She is Tatiana Romanov. From that point, he is locked into this absurd Romanov pretense. He gives Angleton and the CIA every last bit of ammunition it needs to say, the guy's a nut. And from that point, he begins genuinely to lose his sanity. And it's a very sad and poignant decline. But B, the CIA and the US government begin to airbrush Gogonevsky from the history of Cold War spying.
Starting to make sense now, for sure. His name does not come up as much as I would have expected until your book, for sure. But it's clear that they would want to wash their hands of this guy who seeks the spotlight in the way that he does, and in such a false way as well.
Yeah, and do you remember that labyrinthine Polish intelligence service campaign to discredit Gogonevsky and to embarrass the CIA? Well, they were all over this, and the CIA was embarrassed. And, it didn't have that many friends, political friends. It was always under threat on the Hill, on Capitol Hill. And this was manna from heaven. Here's the CIA who is either hiding the best defector the West ever had from public scrutiny, and it did hide him from congressional committees, or it's been taken in by this utter loon who claims to be Alexei Romanov. You can understand why, to some extent, the agency decided, we're going to try and rub this guy's name out of the record books. But at the same time, it too behaved appallingly. It caused, or was part of the cause of Gonyanevsky's mental decline. I mean, what it did in harassing in him and constantly switching between his numerous identities, the identities it had given him, it was, I think, primarily responsible for helping to destabilize the mind of an already damaged individual.
Right. That's a really good point, because it seems kind of on the surface to be like a laughable claim that he is somebody who he couldn't possibly be. But I think over the course of your book, he had something like 6 or 7 different identities that he was shuffling between at all 8 times. It seemed like between the marriage licenses and undercover in East Berlin and everything. Like he was probably somewhat legitimately forgetting who he really was.
Yeah, I mean, he had 8. I counted 8 identities. And, you know, it's quite easy, I guess, for us sitting here in the comfort of our own offices or living rooms and think, well, you know, what's the problem? But, you know, when you're remembering exactly who you were and who knows who, what you are and who you are and where you are, remembering that your life depends on that, and then getting one bit wrong could end up with you up against a wall, facing a firing squad. Mm-hmm. You can understand why it's sensitive. And one of the internal documents I got hold of from the CIA was its own manual, contemporary manual from the early 1960s, for handling defectors. And one of the things that recognizes is the importance of identity and how it's important for an agency, for a CIA interrogator with a defector, to play upon that. And that's what they did. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt when you look at the evidence, and I hope I've laid it out in the book in a way that makes some sense. There's no doubt that the agency was responsible, at least partly, probably primarily, for driving Gonyanevsky insane.
Right. There's certainly a solid case there in the book. The push-pull and the taking his job away and the fight he had with them constantly over things like salary and benefits and living arrangements and everything, because he was totally
he was at their mercy.
Yes, you know, and you know, yes, absolutely.
Bear in mind, he was at their mercy from the moment he defected, and knew from the moment that they finally fessed up and said, "Yeah, we're not the FBI, we're the CIA," that he was putting his life in the hands of an agency he knew was penetrated and he knew he couldn't trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to wonder if he realized at that moment that he had perhaps made a terrible mistake, or did he think, well, it's too late now and let's go?
I mean, he certainly realized that he was placing himself in danger, but it was too late. He couldn't go back. I mean, if he went back, the best he could hope for is a swift bullet to the back of the head.
Mm-hmm. At best, yeah. So how does his story end? I mean, he falls out of the limelight pretty quickly there after making these claims, right? Did he make his way back into the public consciousness again after that?
For probably 20 odd years, he skulls around the grubbier ends of the right, ultra right wing in the United States. You know, he forms temporary alliances with people from the John Birch Society and people like that, anti-communist groups and bogus chivalric orders. And it is really sad to see him being used by them, and indeed them being used by him. And he falls out with absolutely everybody. Whoever tries to help him, he falls out with. And he's impossible, demanding, paranoid, and increasingly in the grip of, the best I can describe it as insanity. He begins in the 70s publishing his own subscription newsletter. I guess, you know, the equivalent of a subscription blog on Substack today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Double Eagle. And it is It's indescribably paranoid and crazy. You know, when he falls out with people, he doesn't just fall out with them. They become villains who he doesn't just pillory in the pages of this newsletter, but he accuses people with whom he's worked and fallen out of being dead Nazi SS officers. So, you know, an author with whom he had worked briefly in 1964, a mild-mannered reporter for the New York newspaper, was denounced publicly and attacked as being, of all things, Reinhard Heydrich, the SS Eminence Grise, who had died in 1942. This was not uncommon. And reading those newsletters was incredibly sad. This was, you know, this man was, had been incredibly courageous. He was incredibly intelligent. And here he was, peddling for a pittance. Madness. I mean, the craziest conspiracy, and not just conspiracy theories, but conspiracy lies that are imaginable. And he does this pretty much towards to the end of his life in 1993.
That's quite a fall from the very heights that he was at in the early 1960s, for sure. That's a very sad epilogue there to his story.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a literal sense, it's a tragedy. It's a personal tragedy. You know, and I like the way you put it. You know, this is a story in three acts. And act three, I found incredibly poignant.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a complex guy, for sure. And I don't think anybody else could have put a finger on his story as you have. But you really laid it out in a wonderful and sensible narrative, you know, just like you mentioned right at the beginning. So I think people are going to love this book once they actually get it in their hands.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I was very lucky to get hold of the documents that I got hold of, because that's what tells the story, these original documents.
Yeah, it's a real treasure trove, and it seems like it was worth the wait, even after as many years as you had to put into this project, for sure. But the payoff is amazing. So thank you so much for talking to me about this today, because this has been one of my favorite stories, for sure, from the Cold War. And the book is called Agent Sniper, The Cold War Super Agent and the Ruthless Head of the CIA by Tim Tate. Tim, is it out now here in the U.S.? I think it came out mid-December.
It came out on December the 14th.
14th. Okay, great. So by the time you're listening to this episode, certainly it's available as well. I've got a copy, and it's wonderful reading, for sure. I highly recommend it to everyone listening to this episode. And, you know, despite the fact that this has been a very detailed story, we've left out a tremendous amount of material, especially about some of the spies that he uncovered working in the West for the Soviets and for the UB and for the East Germans. So really just a fascinating story, Tim. And thank you so much for devoting the time to putting it all together. And thanks for coming on the podcast as well. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for your patience, and thanks for having me.
So is there somewhere else that my listeners can connect with you if they want to? Do you have an online social media presence or anything like that?
Yeah, my website, which also has a contact page should you want it, is www.timtate, that's all one word, timtate.co.uk. And I'm on Twitter, should anyone want that. It's at Tim Tate Books.
At Tim Tate Books. All right, wonderful. I think we're connected already, but if not, we certainly will be after this. So are you working on another book right now? I mean, is this your 18th book or your 19th?
That one's my 18th. The Golinevsky is my 18th book. I'm working on two at the moment simultaneously, and it depends which one comes first will depend on which tranche of documents that I've been chasing for the last 2 years drop first.
Can you tell us anything about give us a preview, or do you want to hold it?
I kind of don't like doing that because, you know, you always think it might, I'm superstitious, it might jinx it. But they're both stories about spies and intelligence and about some really grubby, disgraceful behavior by intelligence services and spies. And I think one of them particularly will shock if and when I can ever finish it.
Wow. Well, I've already bought in completely just based on that little preview. So I'll be one of your first readers for sure, Tim. Thank you again so much. This has been really informative. I appreciate it. Thank you very much
for having me.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101 or connect with me on Patreon. My patrons get exclusive access to long-form blog posts that dive deep into some of the most amazing stories in the history of espionage and receive free or discounted books and products from the Spycraft 101 store. That includes a free PDF copy of my own book, Spy Shots Volume 1, 101 True Tales from the World of Espionage. I want to say a big thank you to all of my patrons, including Eddie A. and Leroy L. With your support, I've been able to continue funding my research and publication across multiple platforms to date. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there's lots more to come.
Thanks for listening to this program brought to you by Daydreamer Network. If you enjoyed the episode, please don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts or your preferred platform. Your feedback allows us to rank on the best new shows list and continue to grow our podcasts in order to bring more unique and talented storytellers to the network. To check out our shows, including programs about relationships, sports, business, nutrition, leisure, and more, head to www.daydreamernetwork.com. We look forward to seeing you back next week for another great episode. Have a wonderful day.